Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest running podcast, now in our 19th year. Today's podcast is brought to you by Pavilion Payments, trusted by over 400 land-based casinos and iGaming sites. Maximize your revenue with better funding options through Pavilion Payments' complete suite of integrated solutions. Enhance player experiences with VIP Preferred, offering quick access to cash, flexible deferred settlement options, and the highest industry limits. Learn more at PavilionPayments.com or visit them at the Global Gaming Expo booth 4411 to discover how Pavilion Payments can customize your check service. And this week we sit down with Bill Miller, the president and CEO of the American Gaming Association. The AGA is more united than ever with a diverse membership that includes gaming operators, suppliers, sports betting companies, iGaming providers, and many more. Bill Miller has been leading the AGA for the last 5 years and has seen the growth and reach of the industry increase each year while strengthening and broadening its base. His State of the Industry address at G2E's October show is always a highlight of the event. He spoke with me via Zoom from his office in Washington, D.C. in August. Bill, thanks for joining us. I'm glad we could do this year. I think we're on a yearly basis now, so I'm glad we could catch up.
Well, Roger, it's always a pleasure. Love doing these things in person, but also, technology is a great facilitator for these kinds of interviews, so I'm happy to be with you.
So let's start off with the record years that gaming has had the past several years. I mean, ever since the pandemic, it's been amazing that, you know, gaming has multiplied its revenues and hit records every year. As we approach the end of 24, has the revenue stream cooled off a little bit?
Well, I think that, in the year, probably the first year after COVID, we really saw this kind of explosion. And I think that there were many people that prognosticators had said, well, you know, this is just pent up demand and stimulus money and that it's going to all, you know, kind of come to a cliff. And I think that, you know, we're three plus years removed from that with still, you know, year on year increases. I think that for Q2 for 2024, we reached $17.3 billion. It's the 14th. Consecutive quarter annual revenue growth. So I do think that things are slowing down. I think they're more normalizing, but part of it is a result of general sense of the economy, and I think a natural kind of return to the mean in terms of growth.
Sure, no question. Now, a lot of that revenue over this time has come from iGaming and online sports betting. And in a lot of jurisdictions, I'm here in Atlantic City, the in-person revenues have been either flat or declining a little bit. Does that concern you that the bricks and mortars casinos aren't necessarily increasing as quickly as the online gaming revenue?
Well, it doesn't concern me. I think it's a kind of a natural really reflection on when new markets get created, new verticals are created, they tend to accelerate much faster than, you know, existing markets. And so, if you try and compare, you know, brick and mortar to iGaming to sports betting, you've got to factor in a whole number of different parameters in there. And so you kind of say, all right, well, sports betting, we didn't have any of it, you know, 5.5-6 years ago. And now we've got, you know, a tremendous amount of growth there. With iGaming, we haven't seen the, you know, massive uptake in growth. But I think that really during the pandemic, almost every brick and mortar property that had a digital property saw success with that. And I think that as that success has been more symbiotic than cannibalistic, I think that what we've seen is in places, in states that have iGaming, those numbers have really grown. But I think that the fact that brick and mortar property can only grow so much within an existing footprint, I think it makes sense that you've seen, you know, significantly higher growth in the verticals that are new or low margin or low capital expense.
Right. So a lot of the problem, the debate between whether online gaming and impacts the land-based gaming, it's kind of been renewed lately. I was speaking with Rob Norton, the president of Cordish Gaming, a few weeks ago, and he was telling me that they opposed the online casino in Maryland because he actually thought it would impact their land-based operations. What do you and you know, of course, the AGA opposed online gaming for years because they feared that would happen. So what do you stand on that now?
Well, I think it's a, I mean, our business is an iterative business, right? I mean, we started off with, in Las Vegas with, a very colorful past, right? And what we've seen is pretty exciting growth all the way across the country in a number of different verticals, including iGaming. But I think one of the most important things that's happened as gaming has grown both in popularity and in success has been that each jurisdiction decides for itself what amount of gaming it has and what types of gaming it has. And so, look, in the state of Maryland, I know that there were a number of different studies that were done with regard to, iGaming hurts, iGaming helps. And I think that it's really, really important for us as an organization to, number one, understand that, you do have to understand where consumers are and where and how they transact. And we've certainly seen that with, not with sports betting, where mobility has been the massive driver in sports betting. And I think it would be foolhardy for us not to at least recognize that consumers are going to want to go where the consumer wants to go. Now, there are many stakeholders and many equities in play in each of these states. And they include brick and mortar casinos. They include, racetracks. They include labor unions. They include taxes paid at different levels. And I think that all of those are really important factors to think about on when and where and if iGaming moves forward. And I think it's part of the reason that its adoption and moving forward has been slowed because those stakeholders, those equities are really important to policymakers. And they should be.
Yeah, no question. So, we as you mentioned, we really haven't seen the growth of iGaming as quickly as certainly as we saw sports betting, even though iGaming has proven to be a better revenue producer than sports betting has been in terms of what the state gets out of it. Why do you think that hasn't happened as quickly as sports betting?
Well, I think that there was kind of a notion that almost all policymakers around the country recognized that their constituents were betting on sports, even when it was illegal in their state. And so the fact that when the Supreme Court ruled in May of 2018 that PASPA was unconstitutional gave everybody the opportunity to give their constituents what they were already doing in today and get some consumer protections, get tax revenue, and create economic activity in their states made just a tremendous amount of sense. And so, I was to laugh about, New York. New York went from, no sports betting to the biggest sports betting market in one single month. And nobody believes that it was because people just thought, wow, I never tried sports betting before. That might be fun. No, of course. And I think that that's the reality around the country as it related to sports betting. And that's why I think that you saw so many jurisdictions move so quickly to, to adopt and pass sports betting legislation. Now, iGaming, again, going back to what I said a couple of minutes ago, there are a lot of stakeholders and a lot of equities involved as it relates to iGaming that aren't necessarily in play as it relates to sports betting. And so I think that's why it has not moved as quickly. And I think that there are very legitimate conversations, very legitimate arguments to be made in these state capitals to make sure that the ecosystem is protected. And so look, I know that, the AGA in its past has had different positions in and around iGaming. From opposition to, in favor to neutral. And I think that that made sense, and it makes sense for us to continue to have within the membership the tough conversations that involve the equities at play, the stakeholders affected, and what does the future look like for the industry. It's also important to remember that, you know, when we did our study on the illegal market, that the biggest amount of illegal activity comes in the iGaming space. And so it is something for us to remember that, you know, if we decide that, or if in the state capitals they decide we're not going to move iGaming forward, the illegal market applauds.
Right. No question about that. So when it comes to legalized sports betting, one of the goals of the legalization of sports betting was to minimize the activity on the illegal sites. Have we accomplished that goal?
No. I mean, and I think it's going to be, you know, I don't know, but, you know, the tale of Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, I think sometimes is appropriate, because the illegal market existed long before the legal regulated marketplace in America and pretty much everywhere else where gaming is legal. Now, have we made progress on it? Absolutely. I think that we definitely believe that, you know, we have made a dent in the illegal market, both in terms of the online offshore illegal marketplace, in sports betting specifically, but I think also in the local sports books. I think that, you know, the local bookie and or organized crime is not as it can't use the same playbook as they've used in the past, which is, if you want to bet on sports, I'm the only guy you can turn to. Now we have legal, regulated, taxed, consumer friendly sports betting, and I think that is has been something that we are proud that we have taken significant market share away from the illegal market.
Right. So just recently, Michigan and Louisiana, sent out a cease and desist order to one of the illegal sports books. And I don't want to say the name to give them any publicity, but do you think that's the way to go? Do you think, obviously, you know, there's thousands of them, so, you know, you have to do it one at a time, or how do you think that's going to work?
First of all, I am really pleased. And I think there was a point in time when, you know, we kind of got to this tipping point where, at first, I think that from a law enforcement perspective, if you sat in their shoes or sat in their chair and said, well, look, all Americans are betting on sports, there's only one place in America where it's legal, shouldn't we turn a blind eye to this since we can absolutely not be able to, you know, get into this? And so, you know, in essence, they called it a victimless crime. And so now we are legal. This is a legal business vertical in, you know, 30 plus state, almost 40 states in America. And so our view is, just like any other legal business in America, we deserve protection from counterfeit, counterfeit drugs, counterfeit, purses and other things. You know, the government and law enforcement, they go to great lengths to make sure that in America, if you're running a legal business and you're paying taxes and you're licensed and regulated and you are offering all the consumer protections, that you should be protected. And that's been the argument that we've made. We've had to make that argument, though, to an audience that previously wasn't appreciative of the legal versus illegal marketplace.
Sure. Right.
You can't blame law enforcement for that.
Sure.
But we now have made some pretty strong successes in working with state's attorney general, with state gaming regulators, and I think even at the federal level. And so our view has been an all of the above strategy to ensure that law enforcement prioritizes protection of our industry and our legal business and uses the tools at their disposal to go after the illegal market. Now, again, it's not easy to go serve papers and or shut things down in places in, you know, Central America or in, you know, other countries.
Right.
And so those are challenges. And so sometimes when I've had these conversations, whether it be at the U.S. attorney level or FBI or state attorneys general, you know, they might say, well, look, you want me to go to Curacao and serve these papers? I'll do it because, you know.
Right.
But I think that, look, the cease and desists, they've worked. I mean, you know, and, you know, it's had effect.
Right.
Is it as strong an effect as when the Department of Justice, you know, basically shut down the illegal poker market globally?
Right.
No, but we're moving in the right direction.
Right. So you mentioned the federal level. You have written letters to the Justice Department to get involved in shutting these things down. Are you concerned though that you're kind of letting them get their foot in the door? You know, if they're going to do that, maybe they're going to kind of try to regulate, you know, the legal gaming.
No, I look, there are plenty of instances of other industries that are principally regulated at the state level that have legal protections at the federal level. And so, you know, look, we have a great and important relationship with the IRS and with Treasury and FinCEN, all important federal agencies.
Right.
And they don't ask us for further, you know, they don't need to have federal oversight over the entire industry.
Sure.
For us to work closely on issues like money laundering and other
right.
things. And so my belief is the federal government has an important role to play. In fact, with the illegal market, they can play an important role. And I think that, you know, some of the things that the Department of Justice has historically engaged in at a very heavy level has been organized crime and chasing organized crime figures across the globe using the powers of the United States government. And so, you know, we were really happy that, you know, like in March, you know, and it was a 2-year AGA effort, you know, we got President Biden to sign legislation that directs the DOJ to investigate and prosecute illegal gambling operators once again. And that is in legislation signed by the president. And we believe that Department of Justice will take notice of that and bring it up, move it up a little bit on the priorities. And I recognize and understand that they have a lot of important priorities over justice.
Yeah.
And so that's why we work with, you know, we do everything that we can with state attorney generals and the gaming enforcement, and with the hope of creating some view so that the federal level, these guys understand there is a role for us to play, and it's an important role to play because this legal industry deserves the same protections that every other legal industry does.
No question. So regulators have always been the lifeline of the gaming industry. They provide the integrity that the public demands of gaming. But when you get into these, you know, these online platforms and things of that nature, it gets very complicated. How can we do anything to educate the regulators in a more coherent manner so that, you know, every time a regulator changes, that they kind of can get up to date as quickly as possible?
Well, I think one of the things we always struggle with, and I think it's in with every industry, this is a constantly evolving industry. It's tech heavy. It's innovation and iterative. And sometimes regulators who have been in positions for a very long time understand the industry from a point in time when different challenges existed. And so it is part of our job, I believe, to consistently try and convene them like we do at G2E every year in Las Vegas, and to, you know, bring these, help and facilitate conversations between regulators about things that are happening and moving in different states. I think that, you know, our partnerships with groups like Nickel G's and others also allow us to spend time with policymakers who actually then can rewrite or revise statutory guidelines for those regulators. But it is important for us to continue to, you know, bring forth, you know, different best working practices in the states in order to make sure that the regulators are keeping pace with the need that and the changes that keep taking place, particularly in a digital gaming environment.
Absolutely. So in my editor's letter in September, in our September issue, I recall the National Gambling Impact Study Commission, and this year is the 25th anniversary of the report that they issued. When they first proposed this this organization, it was proposed by a very anti-gaming congressman, and Frank Fahrenkopf was sitting in your seat in those days, and he helped mitigate the anti-gaming sentiment there, and by putting people like Bill Bible and Terry Lanny and John Wilhelm on the board. And it turned out when the report came out, it actually worked into gaming's favor, because it really reiterated what we had said all along. But now with the controversies around sports betting and iGaming, I mean, there's always a question: are they going to come back and do it again? Are you prepared to handle that if some congressman proposes another study into the gaming business?
Look, there's always some congressman that has some burr in their saddle about something, and right. So in my opinion, I care about numbers. I care about how the gaming industry is perceived, because how the gaming industry is perceived creates the threat level that we have to work under. In terms of public acceptance of the gaming industry, it's never been higher. And yeah. So you've seen it in other jurisdictions. You've seen it in Britain. You've seen it in Spain. You've seen it in Italy and Australia. When the public turns against you, the policymakers are not far behind. Right. And then the couple of two or three of those policymakers that were way ahead of the public are the ones who said, "See, I told you so." And so I care very much about how the public views our industry, the commitments we make in the communities we operate, what we mean in all of those communities. And I think that we've probably stand on firmer ground as an industry than we ever have before. Mm-hmm. We're not reliant on one senator or one delegation. We saw that in COVID. We saw that in the CARES Act when we got federal assistance for the first time in the history of the industry. And that wasn't because of one senator or one delegation. It was because we're in 45 states around the country and people see what we mean in those communities. And so I think that we have a stronger cohort of champions at the federal level among policymakers than we have ever had before. And as it relates to sports betting and the scandals or those things, part of it is lazy reporting. Part of it is poor articulation of what has happened and why it is happening. Mm-hmm. One, number one, the Shohei Ohtani and translator thing, it's almost all the illegal market. Still right. At work, still alive, and still very vibrant. Mm-hmm. We're doing everything that we can to make it harder for the illegal operations to work, but they still exist. And then in the case of actual athletes or coaches or others who have been, have been punished because they were betting in the legal market against NCAA rules or the NBA rules or the NFL's rules. That is the ecosystem working and creating a deterrence effect for others. And so we want to make sure that the games in sports betting, the integrity of the games is not in question at all. And that requires a level of deterrence and sometimes punishment. So my view is, I don't believe there is a higher degree of threat up on Capitol Hill than there was before sports betting. I do think that there is a massive amount of misinformation that goes in and around sports betting that creates this, we're moving towards Britain. The U.S. is just following the same playbook towards the U.K. because of the way sports betting. I think that that's quite frankly not true.
Right. Great. Well, we'll try to spread the news there, the good about it. So we're just a few days short of Responsible Gaming Education Month. A few years ago, it was just a week, so now we've got a whole month, and we're very pleased to be able to help out and do our bit. We've gotten over 20 experts in RG to write for us every day in the month of September. So it's really exciting. I know you guys put out the toolkit yesterday, and I mean that's an important element for operators to use. So what has been the response to the industry and the public to the effort that you guys have put forward?
Well, I think number one, what we recognized, I guess 2 years ago was 1 week wasn't enough. The industry's doing a lot. I think it is important to, remind the public that there's, today there's never been more attention paid or money invested in both RG and problem gambling, and that almost all of that money comes from taxes paid by the industry or financial support to academics or groups like ICRG, and to help facilitate more studies and research so that we better understand, responsible play and where and when people show signs of problem gambling. Because I think that we have an absolute, we have a business obligation, but we have a moral obligation that's tied to the licenses that we hold in all these states to make sure that what we're providing is a fun, safe environment for people, and not believe that and not think that somehow, somewhere that this is a way for people to, create a second job in sports betting or, at the craps table. That's
Right.
not the case. This is fun entertainment. And so as we look at responsible gaming, the moving it to a month, what we saw was we saw a lot of stories that just didn't get light. They didn't get light. And so we had so many members that wanted to participate in this thing that we said, you know what, create a toolbook. Let's start beginning to show what it is we're doing on in a longer period of time. And I think that what we saw last year worked really, really well. And so we're excited about, really setting, setting the story straight on sports betting, making sure that the stories around RG and PG are told appropriately, that we operate with integrity, and under some of the strictest regulations of any businesses in America, and that but that an illegal market still exists, and we want to do everything that we can to make it so that it is harder and harder for those guys to continue to operate.
Great. Well, just one more question, Bill. What are some of the challenges and opportunities as we move forward out of 2024 into 2025?
Well, I think that a lot of the challenges they don't really change. I mean, it
Yeah.
is continuing to tell the story.
Right.
I think that the position that I get to hold is an amazing one because I am the chief storyteller for the industry, and
Sure.
I think that that is a responsibility I take very seriously. And I think about, and I say this to people all the time: we're the industry that goes into the town or city that got left behind by some other industry 30 years ago.
Right.
And the economics in that town were bleak until the casino came in. And there may have been things and people said, oh, we can't have a casino here. Property values will go down, crime will go up, and all the rest of these things. We have consistently, over the last few decades now, beaten that myth down.
Right.
And we now, and it's part of the reason why the public views us as favorably as they do, because they saw the towns that they lived in or they visited, and they saw the contributions that our industry makes in those towns and cities. And then secondly, I think that they look at and I think about, we have commercial and the industry association, we have commercial members, we have supplier members, and we have tribal members. And I think that, in the tribal space, it has truly been transformative to see in 3 generations some of the people that have been, in the worst possible financial straits in America to become, self-sufficient and prosperous. And that happened because of our industry. And we should be really proud of that too. And
Right.
so it's telling the story. It's telling the story about what it is we mean in towns and cities and to people's careers. And I think that so challenges, they're always going to be the same kind of challenges. It's going to be, modernization. How do we as an industry deal with modernization? Should we embrace it? Should we think about what it means within the stakeholder group? I think all of those things play in. And then we have to always think about what the threats are in the illegal market. And certainly, I'm not Pollyannish to believe that somehow or another, because we've legalized sports betting in a number of these states, that now we're not going to have an illegal sports betting market. Of course, we still do. And of course, it's still important for us to gain the appreciation for the legal market by law enforcement and regulators to help get them in the fight. And then I think just to talk more about what we look like and how we operate from a responsibility perspective, I think is, these are the challenges. And then, look, you know, the challenges you can't really predict are, you know, what's the economy going to be? And certainly, you know, we've had a pretty good ride here since the end of COVID, and I'm excited about that. But I also get paid to worry. And so, I'm always worried about, you know, what's the next challenge? And so we do everything that we can to make sure that we're preparing for those challenges but celebrate, you know, the continued good run that we're having.
Great, great. Well, Bill, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it. We're looking forward to your State of the Industry speech at G2E next month, and it's going to be an exciting time there.
Well, great. I'll be excited to see you and everybody else at G2E back in October.
Great. Well, thanks for the time, and we'll see you then.
Thanks for tuning into the GGB podcast sponsored by Pavilion Payments. As the gaming industry's largest vertically integrated payment provider, Pavilion Payments offers solutions that simplify, secure, and optimize the way patrons fund their play. Trusted by over 400 land-based casinos and iGaming sites, Pavilion Payments helps you boost revenue and enhance player experience with VIP Preferred. Discover more at pavilionpayments.com or visit them at the Global Gaming Expo booth 4411 to learn about how their solutions can enhance every casino guest touchpoint, from the cage to the casino floor and online. Don't miss a single episode of the GGB podcast. Subscribe on Amazon, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB podcast.